our love of trees and picking them up after Irma. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There are still piles of debris along roadsides and on curbsides throughout South Florida. Tons of that debris are branches and parts of trees we lost due to Hurricane Irma. Well, for some of us, the loss was devastating because we have such a powerful connection to trees. For others, it's just been a hassle dealing with a cleanup. Today, we'll talk about the trees loved and lost in Irma. Also, a fraternity at Florida International University was suspended for posting very disturbing material in a chat room. The school is still investigating. How should it handle the fallout? All of that and your calls today on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. A Florida International University fraternity is under investigation for possibly possessing nude photos of women taken without their consent. And that's just the beginning. The Tau Kappa Epsilon fraternity has been connected to a series of leaked screenshots of a disturbing group chat. Alex Harris of the Miami Herald is covering the story, and just a warning, the following conversation is going to deal with topics of a sexual nature. Some listeners are going to find this very disturbing. Alex Harris, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Happy to be here.
You know, the fraternity was suspended, my understanding, from any school events until this investigation is finished. But what is that investigation focused on right now?
So the group chat messages kind of had a lot of things going on in them. Most were distasteful jokes, anti-Semitic jokes, conversations about rape and drug use and drug sales. But what looks to be the only criminal activity, I think, that would be able to be prosecuted is these pictures of women. It wasn't clear, obviously, from the pictures or from the school so far, if the women consented to have their photos shared in a group setting. But the school seems to be aware that a couple of those women did not approve of that because they were the ones who stepped up and identified themselves to the school and helped them identify the group that they now say spread the messages.
All right, let's start with how this story even saw the light of day. The administration was tipped off to this online chat by an anonymous source. Do we know anything about this source?
We don't. And I spoke with Larry Lunsford, who's the FIU's vice president of student affairs, and we kind of talked a little bit about who it could be. He says in previous cases, tips can come from former members of fraternities or sororities. It can come from significant others. It can come from someone who just happened to look over the phone. It came from an entirely anonymous email address that the administration has not been able to trace. And like you said, it first came to the light of day in July when the anonymous emailer sent about more than two dozen of these screenshots to administrators and people in Greek life and mentioned it and said that this is a problem and tried to call awareness to it. And the university brought in the group, the Teeks, and asked them if it was them, tried to ask them some questions about it. They denied any ownership or any connection to them and said that they had been hacked. So the university kind of let it go because it was hard to prosecute. And then the anonymous emailer tried again in September, sent an email to a broader range of people, including the heads of all the sororities and Panhellenic members. And that time it seemed to hit a nerve when some of the pictures of women kind of started spreading around and the media started picking up on the stories, including us, the Miami New Times. It was first reported by a student journalist at Her Campus, which is a online news source for FIU. And some of the women in those photos recognized themselves and spoke up to the university administration and said, this is us. We didn't give permission. And they helped identify the people who might have spread the messages. And that was the second time that the university brought the fraternity brothers in and asked questions about it. And as Larry told me, when we brought them in the second time, they couldn't deny it.
And when you said Teeks, that's what they're called. That's
yes.
What this particular fraternity is, the short version of their name.
Right. The longer version would be the Tau Kappa Epsilon. But the nickname the school goes by is for Teeks.
Are we talking about the entire fraternity? Or just a group of people within it?
The full fraternity is about 100 members, or it was when a lot of these screenshots were taken. And from what I could see of the pictures, it looked like there was maybe only a couple dozen members who were active in sending some of the more egregious messages. But as far as we know, the entire fraternity is suspended. Well, obviously, the entire fraternity is suspended, but I think most of the members are under investigation as well.
All right. And again, as you had mentioned, too, was it just that in that second In the second release of this information, that anonymous source comes back and says, you're not taking this seriously enough. This is a real problem. Didn't they also send any of that information to the media as well?
I believe some of it may have leaked out to the media. It's not clear if this person sent it to members of the media or if, you know, people who were on the receiving end of the email list then shared it.
So as mentioned, the school is investigating the sharing of these nude photos, apparently taken without the consent of the women in them. Would that be a criminal offense?
I mean, the sharing of images that you don't have consent for would definitely be on the illegal side. But I think part of the issue here is there was also a mention one of the members of the fraternity asked another to send him nude photos he had of an underage woman who was 17. So that obviously would amplify this into more of a child pornography kind of situation. It's not clear from the screenshots I received yet or from the police I talked to if that picture was actually sent, but it was requested.
Now, you know, with these women, what's the school doing to help them out right now?
So the university has been pretty strong behind the sorority women. It has started an investigation. It suspended the fraternity. And I talked to the student government president, who's also a sorority woman. Her name is Krista Schmidt. And she says that she's had lots of support and felt very she's felt like they've had the proper response. And the university has been very strong. They sent a message to their students saying that this is not their values. This is not what they stand up for. And they obviously said they're extremely disappointed if these allegations are true. But what I thought was the most interesting way that the student body has been responding is that the members of most of the sororities got together and put out a statement saying that they do not want to be associated with this fraternity anymore. They won't go to events with them. They won't do philanthropies. They won't invite them over to their house. They are drawing a line. They're standing up and saying, we think that we were mistreated. They think other women were mistreated, and they're not going to put up with it.
How are other sororities and other women's groups on campus responding to this? And it can't just be this one group. You know, is there anything else popping up because of this now?
It has been a topic of conversation on campus, and I mean, it's kind of a mixed bag. Some people are saying, oh, there's nothing actually illegal was said. It was just distasteful or obscene. But it looks like it also is going to be focused on as part of the movement at FIU called It's On Us. It's a campaign to bring attention to and kind of fight sexual assault on campus. And I talked to Krista again, who is part of that effort, and she said she wants to take this story and use it as an example of the bystander effect. For instance, there were, as we said, about 100 members in this frat, and only a couple dozen of them were really active in this chat. She said all it would take is one of them to stand up and say, this is terrible, we shouldn't be saying things like this, to kind of pour cold water on these conversations. And she really wants to bring attention to the student body of that you can be that one person, you can stand up, you can stop bad behavior, you can stop possibly illegal behavior.
Again, I'm talking with Alex Harris of the Miami Herald, covering the story about the Tau Kappa Epsilon fraternity at FIU. The group was suspended, and they are under investigation for sharing nude photos of women without their consent. But that's not the only thing that was discovered in these leak chat room conversations. Alex, some of the comments were anti-Semitic. Some discussed rape. In one, they were talking about obtaining illicit drugs. Are any of these conversations criminal?
It's not clear yet. I mean, based on other stories in South Florida where messages have been leaked, for instance, at FIU in 2013, a fraternity, Pi Kappa Alpha, was in trouble because their private Facebook group, wherein which they definitely discussed drug sales, drug use, was leaked. And there were no criminal charges for that drug dealing or discussion of drugs. And I mean, in other conversations with fraternity members or with fraternity groups in these kind of situations, it seems like it's hard to prosecute someone if they're just one conversation, if it's just one screenshot. It doesn't seem like that's something that has been gone after in the past.
Someone in that chat room brought up the fact that another FIU fraternity is still under suspension for similar behavior. All right, what happened to, this was Pi Kappa Alpha.
Mm-hmm. The nickname for that is Pike.
Okay.
So they had a private Facebook group that was exposed by another anonymous member, and it was sent to the media, it was sent to administrators, and it was much broader in scope than this group chat. It was a lot more pictures, it was a lot more nude photos of women shared, it was a lot more conversations openly, like people buying and selling drugs. And that ended with the house being suspended for 5 years, which ends obviously next year. It was in 2013, and two members were expelled for that behavior.
Were you able to speak to any of the members of the fraternity being investigated?
I have not. They've kept pretty quiet. They have not spoken to any media as far as I've been aware, but someone from the fraternity did tell me, they released a statement saying that they are fully cooperating with university officials on the investigation.
Who or what governs fraternities and sororities on campus?
So there's the Panhellenic Institution at the University of Florida International University that watches over Greek life and kind of helps them come up with their trainings and make sure everyone's following all the rules. But I think ultimately they would fall under FIU police.
All right. Usually what happens for a fraternity, what has to happen, I should say, for a fraternity or sorority to be completely removed from campus? I mean, does this get anywhere close to that?
I mean, again, you can come back to the only really example we have as close to this, which is the Pikes, Pi Kappa Alpha. They had similar behavior, and they were suspended for 5 years. It's not yet clear. The university has been pretty tight-lipped about whether that is what is going to happen. They've said they're not afraid to kick them off campus for 5 years if they need to. But it's not yet clear if this chat has extended to quite the depths as the Pi Kappa Alphas did in 2013.
Now, what has the university said about the investigation, and usually how long does this take?
It's not clear yet. Probably a couple months on a timeline. The university said they're investigating, and they really have kept it pretty quiet from that point. But they have definitely said that they are disappointed if the allegations are true, and they expect better out of the fraternity members and Greek life people on their campus.
You know, besides these two fraternities, there's another FIU frat that was just suspended for serving alcohol to minors. Is there a reason to think there's a wider problem here?
I mean, that's been a question across the nation, right? For different fraternities and sororities, they have consistently been accused of hazing, of assault on campus, of serving alcohol to minors at parties. And it's not quite clear yet how this will fall. This is definitely falling into a common pattern that we've seen at other universities. For instance, at University of Florida earlier last week, a tape was released to a student publication alleging that it was a sorority member who was talking about some racist and sexually charged hazing that she did among her members. So it's never a surprise when this stuff comes out because it has happened in the past. But every time it does, there's another charge for we need to do better, we need to offer more education, we need to offer more seminars. It's unclear when will be the breaking point and something dramatic will change.
Overall, how are FIU students in general reacting to this?
It seems like it's a pretty mixed bag. Women seem to be pretty disgusted just hearing that this is how men on their campus talk about them behind their backs. And several other people I've spoken to seem to really not see anything illegal. They just see it as distasteful. But other women find this is, you know, proof that this is how people talk about them, and they, you know, distrust Greek life more for it.
Alex Harris, a reporter with the Miami Herald, again reporting on the fraternity Tau Kappa Epsilon that has been suspended and connected with leaked screenshots of a very disturbing nature, again talking about rape, anti-Semitism, illicit drugs, and much more. And again, they're under investigation for sharing of nude photos of women without their consent. Alex, it's been a pleasure. We'll keep up with you on what's going on with this story.
Thanks for having me.
All right, let's change things up a little bit. Coming up next, we're going to be talking about trees, our love of trees, the trees we've lost during Hurricane Irma, and, of course, the cleanup. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Remember the opening lines from Shel Silverstein's The Giving Tree? Once there was a tree, and she loved a little boy, and every day the boy would come, and he would gather her leaves and make them into crowns and play king of the forest. He would climb up her trunk and swing from her branches and eat apples. That was written, more than 5 decades ago, and it still resonates because trees are such an important part of our lives. And it was tough for some people here in South Florida after Irma because their favorite tree was destroyed by the strong winds of the storm. What trees did you lose because of the storm? Why are we so connected to trees? And of course, as we continue the cleanup after the storm, why has it taken so long to get rid of all that tree debris? We'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on what happened during this storm. And, you know, really, basically, what did you lose during the storm and your connection to that tree? 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can also find us online. Find us on Facebook. Look up WLRN Sundial or our handle on Twitter. At WLRN Sundial. Joining me now here in studio first, let me start with Craig Morrell. He is the director of the Kampong in Coconut Grove, Florida. Craig, thanks so much for coming in.
Good afternoon.
And also joining me in studio is Mark Williams. He is the urban forester in Fort Lauderdale, certified arborist, municipal specialist. That's a lot going on that, and there's more, and I'm not even going to get into it, on your business card. Mark, a pleasure to have you.
Likewise. I'm happy to be here.
And joining us from Palm Beach County, Ed Burrow. He's the Parks Resource Superintendent in Palm Beach County. Ed, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. You know what, gentlemen? I mean, let's just start really, you know, looking at with Irma. I wondered, what were your biggest concerns before the storm? I mean, when you talk about trees in different areas, what were those vulnerable areas? And was there anything that you could have done to prepare? Or is it just a matter of Mother Nature's coming? We're just going to have to wait and see. Craig, let me start with you.
Well, it's a really good question. There's no single answer that would answer that. But when we knew the storm was coming, we knew that certain trees traditionally have some damage. Certain species in the kapok tree family are notorious for breaking branches or breaking trunks or just completely falling out of the ground. But we also had some concerns that some of our softer wooded trees or some of our newly planted trees would probably sustain some damage. And we were really surprised, very surprised, because the idiosyncrasies of the storm, even on our little property of 8 acres, which is very narrow but very, very, very long, we saw tornado damage, we saw downburst damage, we saw 3 or 4 different directions of hurricane winds, cyclonic winds, all kinds of things. And some brand new trees stood up, some older trees fell over, vice versa. So there was just no particular pattern to it.
What was the one really most devastating loss from Irma?
We have a tree called a sorrowless tree. It's the genus Soraca. Probably the biggest one in the country. Had the top 2/3 of it snapped clean off. And that was inside of a forest. The forest was fine. That tree took the hit.
And when you say help us understand the size of this tree. There is a picture, by the way, I did see online. But describe this for us.
It was about 30 feet by 30 feet. It's in the legume family and has enormous clusters of orange flowers festooning the trunk and branches, and has bright pink lavender seed pods following that. It's an understory tree. It grows in the canopy of other trees, but this particular one happened to be one of the largest in the country.
How do you explain that, by the way? Like, you'll see a tree. I've lived in Florida most of my life. You'll see this little tiny tree, and it's still standing there so strong. And then something else that looks like it's invincible, a tree that's invincible, it's snapped in half.
Yeah, I think anybody who's been working in public gardens or public landscapes would be hard-pressed to answer that with a single answer. It's now getting to be a better knowledge of what hurricanes do. There's not just a single direction of wind. It could have been a microburst at 6 or 8 feet across. It just hit that one tree. You know, who knows the various combinations that happen that affect a garden? Mark and I were chatting earlier that some trees can be 3 or 4 feet apart. One is shattered. The other one's fine.
Yeah, and it's the thing about storms, because you'll see that with homes as well. Ed Burrow, what about you? What sort of prep work did you have to do before the storm in Palm Beach County, and you know, what surprised you most?
Well, I would say we focused on debris collection. We didn't want any projectiles out there flying around, so we focused all of our staff members collecting the debris that was outstanding. We didn't do any pruning as they recommend, so we just focused on debris pickup and collection. What surprised me most was probably the damage to the sea grape along the beaches. They were devastated in some parks.
Did you learn anything from Irma? Is there anything that we can learn from Irma in prepping for the next storm?
Yes, I think having a routine pruning practice in place is important, because a lot of trees didn't have a good structure. They didn't have a single leader. They were co-dominant, and they were very unsound. So having that, a pruning practice in place would help benefit during the next storm.
Mark Williams, in Broward County, around Fort Lauderdale, what did you do to prep for the storm? What surprised you most after the storm?
Well, as far as prep goes, a lot of what Craig and my other colleague mentioned, we had a lot of the same preparations, making sure all of our debris were taken care of as best we can. We also had a list of trees that either had a significant distinction for the city. We have a trees of distinction that went out and took a look at those to at least document them beforehand. And also took a look at some of the trees that were near construction areas or that recently had had root impacts. Because typically when you have a high wind storm event like a hurricane, if a tree has a compromised root system, that's definitely going to be one you want to take a look at first.
You talk about trees of distinction, like what?
We, unfortunately, the city of Fort Lauderdale lost two rather large tallypot palms that were considered trees of distinction. They had historical significance. They were very, very large. They were unique to the area, and they both were blown over and destroyed in the storm. It was a shame to lose them, but when it comes to hurricanes, even the best, well-maintained, well-structured tree can go over.
How big a tree are we talking here?
The tallypot palms were a good 40, 50 feet tall. They're not native to Florida. They're originally from India. They handle salt pretty well, but unfortunately, where they were installed, they were exposed to a lot of high winds. They were near canals and waterways, so they took the brunt of the wind from the storm.
I had also read that at Flamingo Gardens in Broward County, they lost a very big tree. You know about this one?
That I'm not familiar with.
Okay. I'd read that it was it's really South Florida's tallest tree, actually. It was an 84-year-old Carina, I hope I'm saying that right, an exotic tree native to West Africa, towered at 134 feet and destroyed during the storm.
Yes. I can't speak a whole lot about that particular tree, but some similar-sized live oaks at Snyder Park in Fort Lauderdale blew over and blew apart, and it was mainly because of excessive ground saturation. Trees use their root systems to anchor in the ground, and when you have a whole lot of water that sits there for a long time, they tend to lose their effectiveness, and we had quite a few trees blow over specifically because of that. And without knowing more about the tree, I would suspect it's probably has something to do with that. It may be related to some type of decay or other issue, but that's about all I can answer.
All right. Again, the number is 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. What is our love of trees? What did you lose during the storm? Maybe you have a question about pickup, because there is still a lot of debris that is sitting around on roadsides and curbsides. How long is it going to take to get that stuff picked up? Wherever you live in South Florida, we want to hear from you, because we want to get a feel for the extensive damage throughout South Florida, from the Palm Beaches all the way down to the Keys when we talk about trees. All right, let's go to the phones. I want to start with Deborah in Lake Worth. Deborah, how are you doing?
Hi, hey. I'm enjoying the show very much. I am a master gardener in Palm Beach County, and just want to let your listeners know that University of Florida, which of course has a county extension in every county, they have an online list of all their articles on agriculture, lawns, landscape. And they've done extensive research in the past 20, 30, 40 years about which trees are hurricane resistant in Florida, in South Florida. And you can access that online, EDIS, Electronic Data Information System, University of Florida, Hurricane Resistant Trees. A base of native trees in your yard makes your yard more resilient to hurricanes. Not perfect. If I lost one of my Hercules clubs, a native tree in my yard, but I think it was a little tornadic wind that went through that little area. But all the rest of them, my sables, my wild tamarind, everything came through beautifully.
All right. Deborah, so hurricane-resistant tree. Deborah, thank you so much for the call and giving us that update. I appreciate it. Is there a hurricane-resistant tree? Craig, I saw you kind of shaking your head a little bit, maybe. I don't know.
Well, there's too many variables. You can have even a really well-established native species, native to a particular area, and drop a tornado on top of it. Nothing can be done.
Between native and non-native trees, can we say one did better than the other?
Nope.
It doesn't matter in the
store. Nope. I think there's entirely too many variables at this point. I can only say that if you had a hammock or a forest of native trees that had been there for several hundred years and it has withstood hurricanes and tornadoes this long, they would stay up.
All right.
I don't think you can draw categorical lines between natives and exotics other than some natives are a little tougher than some others.
Ed Burrow, you know, that caller was coming up from your area up in Palm Beach County. Just wanted to get a sense of what you saw when it came to native and non-native trees, or it really just what the extent of damage, tree damage in Palm Beach County.
Yeah, I have to agree with Marker Craig. We saw damage to non-natives, but we lost a lot of natives. But especially in Lake Worth, we saw four massive ficus trees come down. They were probably there for, well over 50 years, and they came down. But then we also had, sea grape, which was on the beaches, and, they got obliterated. So, you had both sides, the native and non-native trees being impacted.
All right. Again, 800-743-9576. Love your questions, your comments about maybe you lost a tree. I know that one of my coworkers, her two sons were really, really sad about the fact that they lost a tree in Irma, and it was their favorite tree. What is our love affair with our trees? But also, if you have questions about cleanup, pickup of the tree debris, because I know there's still a lot of it out there. Maybe perhaps you have a tree that was damaged in the storm. How do you know if it's salvageable or if it's just dead? 800-743-9576. Let's go back to the phones. Let me go to Tony in Redland. Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, for taking my call. I'm really thrilled to hear this show. I own a particular grove in the Redlands. It's about 3 acres, and it's a multi-use grove. I have many different plants, but I'm calling about one particular tree, which I had experience with, which is a rainbow eucalyptus. That I have planted on my property. I'm actually here right now, and it's about 75 feet tall. And I planted it about 10 years ago, and I planted it post-dandruff, and I had never seen it react in a hurricane, so I wasn't sure. It was just right about after Wilma. And the tree made it. I planted it. Many people laughed at me because I made a huge, huge hole for it. I mean, it was a great big pit, and it was a 3-gallon pot, and everyone told me, why am I making this huge hole? I said, why am I? And I'm not sure if it's going to hold up. And actually, I had very strong winds. I lost much of my grove, but many of my neighbors lost their rainbow eucalyptus, but mine stood up. So I was just wondering if anybody had experience with the rainbow eucalyptus and what they felt about it.
All right, Tony, thanks so much for the call. I knew your line was cutting a little bit out there, but we got most of that. Come on, you guys. What's the word, Mark? You were laughing a little bit.
I'll go ahead and weigh in a little bit. I'm a little surprised it did as well as it did. Typically, eucalyptus are a very fast growing species, and normally with storms, if you've got a tree species that grows really, really quickly, they tend to blast apart and have issues when it comes to wind events. But he alluded to something that caught my attention. When it comes to initial planting, that's very important no matter what species you're talking about. Typically, a common mistake people make is they'll either plant a new tree too far down into the hole or too high. If you plant it just about at soil grade, if not just a little bit higher, which it sounds like is what he did, and he also dug out a rather large pit, and I'm assuming that he put in the proper soil amendments and everything that the tree needed to establish a really good root zone. That's important. If your tree is anchored really well and it happens to have, I'm assuming it had good structure, it can survive a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It sounds like he did some really good things when it came to planting.
You know what? I just noticed something, and I noticed is that after the storm, I'm driving around and I see, some trees just completely uprooted and they look like these big, strong trees. I'm like, what? I don't know. Is this something about certain trees, their roots don't go deep enough, or is it the way that they are planted?
I would say that it was the way they were planted. Yeah. The gentleman with the eucalyptus hit it right on the head. Is there's an old adage, you plant a $5 tree in a $50 hole. People skimp on the hole, on the size of the planting hole. And unfortunately, we're no longer able to blast and make really good fractured rock planting holes. But people always go cheap on the planting holes, and that can make a huge difference as to whether the tree establishes in the first few years.
All right, let me go back to the phones. Got a lot of calls coming in, talking again about our love of trees. What did we lose during the storm? And, of course, cleanup. Let me go to Christian in South Miami. Christian, welcome to the program.
Hi, how you doing?
What do you got for me?
Well, in our case, unfortunately, we lost a really nice avocado tree that did a lot, had a lot of fruit on it. But on the flip side, one of the things that's been really fun for myself and my three kids is we found this beautiful 4.5 diameter trunk of an oak tree that we brought home, and we have it in our garage. And we've been working on it. We've debarked it. We've been sanding it. We're drying it out, and it's going to make for a magnificent coffee table. So I think you know, there's still some real nice pieces of wood out there for people who want to turn this disaster into a nice memory.
Recycling.
Yeah. No, you know what? I mean, that brings up a good point. Christian, thanks so much, and I'm glad that you were able to do that. You know what? I mean, there are people who are complaining that there is just a lot of debris out there. When is it going to get picked up? Some of it could take a long time, but I wondered about that. I wondered about, you know, do you ever tell anybody, well, if you've got the tools, cut that up, turn it into mulch or turn it into furniture or, you know, what? I mean, I don't know. What kind of stuff do you hear from folks?
Turn it into edging for garden beds. Line your driveway.
Yeah, edging, mulching, making furniture. I mean, oak wood is prized for those things. So,
by the way, what happens to the debris? Do we know? Where is it going? Where is it being taken?
A lot of it heads out west of Chrome to extremely large debris piles, and it's either chipped or burned. Usually these days it's chipped.
I think about the nun with the chainsaw. I wonder what she did with that debris. I really do. Let me go to, let's see. I've got Kim in Key West. Kim, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. How are you guys doing?
We're doing all right. Thank you so much for calling. What do you got for me?
Well, you started out with the Shel Silverstein quote, and I just wanted to let everybody know down here in Key West, you know, he used to live here, and his house got destroyed by, guess what, the giving tree.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it fell on top of the house. So we were all devastated, but, you know, we loved Shel when he lived here, and, you know, it's a change, and it is what it is. But I just wanted to let you know.
Okay. And my understanding, though, he did write that book before he bought the house in Key West.
Oh, yes, he did. But all of a sudden, he had this beautiful tree, and he always called it the giving tree while he lived here.
Yeah. All right. Kim, thanks so much for letting us know. Appreciate that. All right. Again, the number 800-743-WLRN. Let's go to, is it Danila? I think it is in Hollywood. Danila.
Yes, it is, Danila.
Okay. Welcome. Thank you so much. Saving trees, what do we got?
Yes. Okay. Two things. One comment. We bought the house just because of the trees. The house is tiny in Hollywood, but the trees are beautiful. It's a 40-year-old avocado tree, a jacaranda tree. Both withstood the hurricane. But my question was now, your host mentioned that the saturation is a problem. And this Irma hurricane was mainly a wind hurricane and less water, but the ground was completely saturated, as he said. And is there a way to study it in prevention for the next hurricane to pile up soil to, I don't know, like really to prevent it from the ground? We chopped it off halfway. So everything is halfway now it was before, but just as a prevention for next one.
Okay. Let's see. I've got a few guys in here. A couple guys in here might answer. Mark, what do you got?
Sure. When it comes to managing water, there's only a limited amount of things you can do. The first thing you can look into is making sure the drainage on your property is correct. Oftentimes, if you have drainage culverts or basins nearby your property and they're clogged and filled, water won't flow off your property the way that it should. That's an easy fix. It's something you can check with your municipality or city, or even you can do it yourself if time is of the essence. Another thing you mentioned, when it comes to piling soil, that's not a good thing for trees. You typically don't want to dump soil in the root zone. It tends to act as a smothering agent and can actually kill the root zone of the tree. So you don't want to do that necessarily. If you have some concerns, you can possibly get a general contractor out there or a soil specialist, or even take some samples to see what's the makeup of the soil that you have around the trees, what can be done as far as amendments go. Are the trees planted on top of coral rock, as was alluded to earlier? That can be an issue if water doesn't drain that way. These are things you want to know when you come up with a plan for trying to preserve what sounds like really fantastic trees.
All right.
Yes, they are. And we just really bought the house only because of the trees. So we are very happy. Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I want to take one more call here before we go to break. And I want to get in Michelle and Sugarloaf Key. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. How are you? I'm so glad you're doing this program, because I didn't want to feel like the only one that mourns her trees.
No, there are a lot of people.
I mean, that's really the only thing that really saddened me and made me feel really sad to the point of tears was my trees. I had, they were the palm trees. They were mostly 30 feet tall, and they were on either side of my property, and I had planted them by hand and watched them grow, and they made it through all the hurricanes. But since we got hit with 176 miles an hour, and like someone said before, with the tornadic winds and the picking up They went down, but they went down still trying to protect my house, and I just feel really bad about it, and I'm glad other people feel the same.
All right. Well, Michelle, sorry for your loss. Are you going to replant?
Well, yes. Some of the volunteers, I must say that the church, we were like the third world down there with how we got hit, and all the different churches came down with their volunteers, and they were coming in to help us with our trees, with our everything, and so they have taken pups. I call the little palm trees as they drop their coconuts and they grow. That's like their little pups. So they're helping me try to go around and plant those and give my trees a good bereavement burial. And I never thought about making a table out of one of my favorite trees, but that could be a possibility too. But I just want to be in solidarity with the rest of the people that lost their beloved trees that they planted from little pups.
All right, Michelle, thanks so much for sharing that. Again, sorry for that loss, but we rebuild. That's what we do. You know what? Let's
Bar to strong. We'll come back.
There you go. You know what? Let's take a quick break. I want to come back and get some of these more of these phone calls and again talk with the gentleman that I have joining me on today's program again about the trees that we've lost during Hurricane Irma, but also any questions that we have about replanting, perhaps. If you are going to replant, perhaps what advice would be best in the types of trees that you replant. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. More on trees coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, joined in studio by Craig Morrell from the Kampong in Coconut Grove, Mark Williams, the urban forester in Fort Lauderdale and certified arborist municipal specialist, and then we're also joined by Ed Burrow from Palm Beach County. He's the Parks Resource Superintendent. And again, we're talking about trees in today's program and again, what we lost during Irma. But any questions you may have about replanting or cleaning up of debris, we'd love to hear from you. We've got a lot of phone calls coming up. But, you know, before we do, Craig, you were just mentioning to me, because you had said about pruning, but we have to clarify something, right?
Right. And I think one of the principal concepts in pruning trees to make them more resistant to wind is not cut their tops off, but it is to try to reduce a lot of the congestion in the center of the canopy so that air can flow through the tree. So when we talk about pruning trees, and Mark would be much more qualified to talk about the details, the idea would be to get the tree to a good, strong canopy structure such that you have spaced branches. In other words, you don't want a meatball on a stick, which you see a lot in urban landscapes. People all want the trees exactly the same size, you know, Boca Raton style. The idea there would be to have the trees, the interior canopy thinned out, and you would be talking about words like canopy reduction, not just pruning. And that dives deeply into some political and legal issues too. But people say, oh yeah, we'll prune the tree for $50.
Yeah, Mark, I mean, how do you get around the fact that people want trees to look a certain way? I mean, that's just, you know, and you're talking about different neighborhoods, and you may even deal with homeowners associations. I'm just talking about the fact that people want their tree to look a certain way, and he's talking about, well, in pruning to protect it, it may not look the way you want it.
He's exactly right. You're talking about a comparison between aesthetics and structure. When it comes to tree pruning, the general rule of thumb is less pruning is more. The common question I get asked the most often is, how often do I need to prune my tree? And honestly, each tree is different. The good rule of thumb to follow is you should have your trees evaluated at least once annually. That's once a year by an ISA-certified arborist or a licensed and insured tree professional who's been through special training and knows how to properly prune your trees. I have many stories and nightmares of trees pruned by the common moniker is a pickup truck and a guy with a chainsaw. It causes a lot of issues, a lot of heartache. And unfortunately, it paints a lot of the people in the industry in a bad light in that case. But when it comes to how should you prune your trees, you can have both an aesthetically good-looking tree and a well-structured tree. But the key is using somebody or hiring somebody who knows what they're doing, knows a lot about trees, knows about proper pruning. In the case of Broward County, you even have to have a license through Broward County to even trim trees. They're the only county, I believe, in the state that does that.
You know, before I go back to the phones, Ed Burrow, I wanted to ask you real quickly. I don't want to forget this one. You know, right after the storm, there were a lot of parks that were closed because of tree damage and damage to the parks. But have those parks been cleaned up and fixed up? I mean, what kind of damage did you see?
Yeah, so we experienced a lot of limb failure, as they call them, hangers in the industry. So we focused on those safety concerns first, but we don't have any more safety issues in our parks. All of them are open. So, but we those were the main issues we found were trees uprooted or fallen over and the hangars.
And you know what? I mean, you got calls from people. People wanted to get back to the parks, like, right away. People wanted to go back to the parks to get outside, right?
Absolutely. After being cooped up inside, you know, all day, people were itching to get outside, and, you know, school was canceled, so they wanted to bring the kids somewhere, and everybody turns to the parks. You know, they want to go to the playground. They want to go to the beach. And we try to accommodate as much as best we could to get the parks open in a timely manner.
All right, I want to go to the phones here and get some more calls in. Again, talking about trees. It's our love of trees today. I want to start with Fran and Davey. Fran, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi, Fran.
Hi, yes, you were just talking about parks, which is exactly what I'm calling. There's a park in Davey called Wolf Lake Park, and I ride horses. And many of us that ride horses depend on that park to exercise our horses, to go to the lake, and the horses can wade in the lake. It's been closed since the hurricane, and we have no idea when it's going to be opened again. And people from North Miami all the way up to Plantation and above use that park to ride in. And it's been really hard because, you know, it's like it's fun to ride your horse around a rink, but when you used to have park, and we're at Merlin Stables, which is right down the block from the back entrance to Wolf Lake. And the city of Davie hasn't really given us any answers as to when it'll be open. We've tried to volunteer. I know that's a kind of a problem because of liability, but the trees in there are old. Some of them just fall down while we're on a normal day, and talk about replanting and revitalizing our parks, and nothing like that's been done in Wolf Lake. And still in all, it's a great place, and I really hate the fact that we're not able to use it.
And you said that the city hasn't given you any answers about cleanup
or
when it's going to be ready.
No, it's open on the front entrance and just for people with their dogs, but not for the horses. And it really is one of the few places in the area, in fact, except for Treetops Park, which is much further away, where you can ride your horse. And we really depend on that park, and it's not there for us. And it's a shame. And like I said, the trees in there are old and brittle, a lot of them. There's really been very little done to maintain those trees that I can see.
Okay.
And well, I don't know how many people even know about Wolf Lake Park.
You know what? It's something I want to look into now to see what's happening there. But, you know, as you said, some of the old, I wonder, you know, in upkeep of parks, that's also an interesting question as well. Fran, thank you so much. I appreciate that. I hope they get that park up and running for you as soon as possible.
And I'd love it if you would look into it because it's a great place and worth looking into.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Fran.
Bye-bye.
You know what? I mean, it's been, what, six, 7 weeks? It's been more than almost 2 months, almost since the hurricane. Have you heard of that, of any parks or any other places that are still closed?
Definitely. One in Fort Lauderdale, actually. I mentioned it earlier, was Snyder Park. And it had to do with a lot of large-sized trees that fell over. It just takes a long time to actually deal with removing the debris from those trees, and also just due to the sheer volume of trees throughout the entire property, it's a matter of making sure the park is safe for residents and neighbors to actually use. So that may be a matter of looking at each individual tree and making sure there aren't hangers or dead wood hanging out in the tree that could hit somebody that's walking by. It's a time-consuming process.
Is the county responsible for that, or you're just contracting out people to come and get that?
Snyder's a city park, so okay. We're actually doing the work ourselves with the assistance of contractors. But in this case, she was talking about the Davie Park. I would assume Davie is probably following a similar protocol.
All right. Let me get through a couple more of these calls here. Let's start with Mark in Coconut Grove. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm calling in reference to an anecdote I remember hearing after Andrew, and was wondering if A, it was true, and B, if it's being used and after this hurricane. And that was that a bunch of the refuge, the wood refuge, was actually shipped to Haiti to be used as fuel.
Okay. Anybody hear of that? I have not heard of that. No. Shipped after Andrew, shipped as fuel to Haiti.
Yes, something about them having a massive deforestation over time and how it was very valuable for them. And like I said, anecdotes.
Yeah.
But I heard it from several sources, and it sounded like a great idea. I mean, I don't know the logistics and value proposition, but I was wondering if you guys had heard about it.
Nobody here has. We're all shaking our heads, but something I can look into. Mark, thank you for bringing it up, though.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. All right, let me get one more in here real quickly because we got to go to break. Let me go to Steve in Pompano. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Hey, thank you for having me. I have just a quick question. I planted silver buttonwoods in my swale probably two and a half years ago, and it was required by the city. They were probably 2.5 to 3 inch single trunk buttonwoods. And they're up to 4 to 5 inch trunks, still single wood. And I keep them, try to keep them somewhat trim. But for the storm, all three of them blew over.
Okay.
And I propped them back up. I pulled them back up with the truck, propped them up. Everything's fine. And they're absolutely, I didn't even lose a leaf on them. And I was looking, and it doesn't even appear to be a taproot at all. It's almost like a bush. And I just, is there anything I can do to prevent the next storm or strengthening, you know, after I was probably going to keep the stakes and keep them tied up for maybe a year just so that they reattach properly, but then just trying to maybe keeping them shorter.
All right, well, let's get an answer for you real quickly here. Anybody here want to jump on that one?
Go ahead, Craig.
All right, Craig.
Well, I would have some issues, or some add-ons. Silver buttonwoods normally are multi-trunk. And they have a tendency to sort of lay over and root on their secondary trunks. I would certainly leave it tied up for more than a year. I tend to be more conservative and go to 2 years.
Okay.
And three is try to select some of the vertical branches inside that large bush-like tree. Prune those out down to the nearest branch, to the branch collar, and let some air go through the tree.
Right. And yeah, just a thin amount, not to crop it at the top.
Exactly.
Right.
All right. Well, Steve, there you go. Thank you so much for the call. I appreciate it. I just have to run through this real quickly. So thank you
all
so much.
Thank you.
You know what? We'll skip the break here. We just got a few minutes left in the program, though. I did want to get one more call in here. I've got Valerie in Biscayne Park. Valerie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Yes.
I wanted to tell you, my grandmother's name was Ethel Barbara Smith. Oh, that's a parrot in the background. Sorry. She was a botanist, and she graduated from Florida State in 22 when it was a women's college. She had a TV show on WPBS as the plant lady in the late 1950s. And this is an old cracker technique that she taught me for planting trees. You dig a hole really deep, and you put a piece of pipe in the hole. Then you put your amendments in, you know, put the sand in, the dirt in, and then you put the tree in. But you make sure that the pipe stays at the top of the pipe at ground level. Okay, then what you do is you keep putting the water in the pipe. And that way the roots, instead of staying up on the surface like our roots do looking for water, that way the roots keep going down, down, down to get that water source. And they anchor themselves into the ground. And that basically hurricane-proofs them.
Okay. All right, Valerie, well, you know, I had to stop only because of time, but thank you for sharing that with us. Look, I'm the guy with no green thumbs. So, I mean, does that work? Is that what you said, real?
I've heard a variant of that tactic, but it does. And there's an old sage about water deeply, the roots will go after it.
Okay.
And that's a good way to do it. I haven't seen that technique used in the last 30 years, but it would work.
Let me finish with this because we got a couple of minutes. Ed Burrow, let me start with you real quickly. Again, we're almost 2 months out from Irma, but how would you describe, really, just briefly, you know, the recovery in Palm Beach County and what have you learned?
It's been phenomenal, the recovery here in Palm Beach County. We learned that working with other agencies really helped get the job done. We partnered with SWA to collect a lot of our vegetative debris, and that freed us up to work on safety issues inside the park. So definitely partner up with other agencies and, you know, prepare and do the structural pruning regularly, schedule.
Mark Williams, you know, what can you say about the post-Irma experience? We've been through a lot of hurricanes. Was there something unique about this one, though?
Not in terms of my experience. We've seen a lot of the same issues we've had in past events, although I think with this one, we're a little better prepared than we've been in the past. Each hurricane, each event that we go through, we learn a little bit more on things that we can do better. Fort Lauderdale itself has some really good tree giveaway programs, for example, that we've been pushing even before the storm hit that are going to help us take a chunk out of all the trees that we've lost.
And Craig Morrell, I mean, how's the campong doing? And you know, it's what does it look like now?
It's recovering, but we try to coach people that just because trees have a few leaves on them doesn't mean they've recovered. We're looking at a 3 or 4 year restoration time. But also we're trying to do some public education about the idea that this is a hurricane that hit over a long period of time. So that Saffir-Simpson scale really should include a time function to it, too.
This has been an amazing experience for everybody, no doubt. Obviously, a lot of people losing the trees that they love so dearly, as we've heard from some of our listeners, and we're still going to be cleaning up a lot of that debris for quite some time. Craig Morrell, again, is the director at the Campong in Coconut Grove. Mark Williams, again, urban forester in Fort Lauderdale, and Ed Burrow, Parks Resource Superintendent in Palm Beach County. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. I really appreciate your time
today.
Thanks
for the invitation.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And that is our program. By the way, you could share your thoughts if you didn't get in today's program. You can find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, or again on Twitter, our handle, at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear from you. That's the program. You can find this on iTunes, always WLRN Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk tomorrow.